The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings to everybody in Canterbury and the Wairarapa and the top of the South Island. Thanks very much for joining me for today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood, Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Well, today we're going into Climate Matters 142, and again, my apologies, we might be a bit dislocated because the CM142 went out in the middle of November, and you're likely listening to this in the middle of December because we're still in catch-up mode from all the interviews and the COP specials and methane special and so on. So anyway, here's what we've got in store today. First of all, we'll have a quiz. Secondly, food for thought from Hannah Ritchie, the data specialist on nuclear power, and lots more. And then thought for food, something to ruminate on, is how I've headed it. Then some big questions we're not asking, and that also relates to Hannah Ritchie's piece. And then a glimpse into COP30 and what's known as pre-COP in Brazil. Finally, our plug-in hybrids, plug-in hype. So let's get into it, into Climate Matters number 142. Well, thanks for the great feedback on the methane special that we did, which actually seemed to offer welcome help to people in joining some of the dots on the shonky game that this government is playing on climate and on other things. Climate Matters 142 this time covers the usual potpourri of topics and includes a quiz for fun, as I mentioned, but not yet the government's further backtracking on climate, because between the methane special and now, there's been further bad news from this government. It doesn't seem to stop, does it? Anyway, let's get into the quiz. What is Kaya decomposition? Kaya, that's K-A-Y-A. Kaya decomposition, and what is its climate significance? And here's a tip. It's not a special form of composting. Okay, carrying on from there, food for thought, Hannah Ritchie on nuclear power and more. I've often quoted Hannah Ritchie, as you'll recall, and I've also often quoted Yale E360, their publication. And in this case, we're reporting the two of them arriving together in one package where Yale Environment 360 interviews Hannah Ritchie. And Ritchie, who you may recall, is an anchor person in our world in data. She's a great at analytical thinking. She doesn't disappoint us here and offers unexpected angles based on her own statistical analysis. She talks about China's coal-fired power stations, on nuclear power, on the uptake of EVs, on AI and its energy demands, and more. It's well worth a read. Of course, we'll give a link for you in the program notes. But also, please hang in there, because when we get to big questions we're not asking, they also relate to Hannah Ritchie's piece. So we'll get to that in a moment. Thought for food, something to ruminate on. I was doing something at the edge of my property in Nelson a week or two ago, and a local called Henry introduced himself to me and posed me two questions, which I'm picking up on here. The first question was, what percentage of methane emissions comes from beef and lamb livestock in New Zealand? Well, I happen to know that it's roughly 25% each, with the other 50% from dairy. But Henry wasn't really trying to catch me out. He was leading into a wider discussion, which is evident when we get to his next question, which is, how much methane do horses emit? And I didn't know the answer to that, but I Googled it, and Elsevier, the research house, tells me it's about one-third of the emissions of cattle through hindgut fermentation, is what it's called. because horses are not ruminants. Anyway, I expect you've got Henry's Drift now. And then he, to put it more in context, he said to me, we should get over the Anglo-Saxon bias that horses are too noble to eat. So there it is. Thank you, Henry. I, of course, Googled it, and it landed me on a very measured article, which we'll also link to, and its title tells you what it's about. It's called Horse Meat Tastes Exactly Like Beef, and I Bet You Couldn't Tell the Difference. So you can follow a link to that. And, of course, there's a lot more to switching from beef to horse meat than just the above figures. I don't know what fencing requirements are for horses. They've got a reputation as mean feeders. And anyway, why not just eat less meat in our diets? But I view this as a case of yes if rather than no because. Let's find reasons why it might work and go from there. For me, the core point is we have to get our heads around doing things differently, especially in the quest to decarbonize our lives. And Henry's line of thinking, I think, is a great example, definitely worth a thought. But even if we don't go as far as horse meat, if we're just dealing with bovine meat, with cow meat from cows, there are plenty of studies on dairy cows as a lower emission source of beef than having a distinctive beef herd. Here's a quote from Ag Research, the New Zealand organization, and I'm quoting, integrating dairy and beef production would enable the New Zealand beef sector to reduce annual greenhouse gas emissions by nearly 2,000 kilotons of carbon dioxide per year. That is 2 million tons. And that, astonishingly, is between 3 and 4% of our total national emissions. So that's a big deal. Here's a further quote from them. Beef produced from cattle from New Zealand's dairy sector could provide reductions in greenhouse gas emissions of up to 48%. So that's something we should think very seriously about. Science Direct, another research paper also on New Zealand dairy and beef, is more cautious about the emissions savings, but it still suggests that we could reduce New Zealand's methane from beef by 22% by using dairy cattle. Very much worth a thought. And one way or the other, I don't know what the taste difference is, but we should just think how badly do we really want to hang on to beef stock or beef herds of cattle just for the sake of them growing beef. Okay, going on. Big questions we're not asking. So I've just quoted Hannah Ritchie and her article within Yale's Environment 360. But even her responses illustrate blind spots that I think to our peril permeate so much of our thinking on some very big issues. I wish Hannah Ritchie would apply some wider boundary thinking to her otherwise admirable work. And I've said something along those lines before, but I'd also stress that Hannah Ritchie is far from alone in this. I wouldn't be mentioning it to try and call her out. I'm mentioning it because these are systemic problems, in my view. And it just happens that the one Yale article illustrates many points. So here are four questions. Question one, why do we almost always discuss the energy transition just as cranking on using energy at present levels, but from different sources? We seem to think we just got to keep our very high energy lifestyles. And to put it a bit in perspective, in present day New Zealand, we use about 3 to 4 times the energy per capita that our parents did 60 years ago or so, or 50 years ago. We, as a general Western society, use about 70 times the energy of Middle Ages times. So there's a huge energy intensity to our lifestyle, and it's critical we discuss how best we can get to what's an inevitable lower energy society, and we'll be the better for it so many ways if we get our heads around it, rather than just wait for it to hit us between the eyes. And also, just as a different perspective on the same thing, quoting from Hart Hagen, who's another environmental journalist, is the quote, a species that causes the extinction of 150 other species a day doesn't need more energy to do more of the same. That's not the first time I've quoted that. You may recall it from prior issues of Climate Matters. Here's question two. Why is net energy gain, sometimes referred to as EROI, or energy cost of energy, still off the energy radar? There's extensive literature on us running an energy economy, not a monetary one. I've given a link there to surplus energy economics. I've talked about this before. The related concept of net energy gain, that is, what's left for us to use after we've deducted the energy we need to access the energy in the first place. That concept points convincingly to the already unfolding constraints of every current energy source, from wind to shale oil to nuclear. The sort of difficulties we're experiencing as a society now, supply problems, constraints on public services, all sorts of things, in many ways can be traced back to our weakening energy supply situation. I've actually contacted Hannah Ritchie and asked her to do a piece on this, and she wrote back in a positive vein, so I'm hoping she will. Watch this space. Question three, why aren't we discussing minerals blindness, as guru Simon Michaud exposes and has been exposing for years? We referenced that in Climate Matters 134, and there's a very full discussion with Nate Hagens. We'll also link to that. And Michaud has got his own website where he discusses it, sometimes with eye-watering figures, but very convincing maths. The world will struggle to achieve one generation of renewable energy hardware. That is, the first lot of wind turbines, the first lot of solar panels and all the rest of it, let alone keep it all running. Most of that hardware has a life expectancy of around 25 to 30 years, i.e., we should think of being able to replace it all in 25 or 30 years. And yet we really probably will struggle to get all the minerals and stuff we need just for the first iteration, let alone to keep the whole system running, which rather calls the bluff of one of Hannah Ritchie's arguments, the sense that the energy needed for AI doesn't really matter because we just have to build more generation. Sorry, Hannah Ritchie, but I don't agree on that. We actually have to try and avoid how much generation we need to build. And I think it's worth just as a little footnote in there saying all of the energy generation, even for renewables, requires fossil fuel for the extraction of minerals, etc., etc. We have yet to electrify the minerals industry. Question four, do we really want to replace all of our fleet with electric vehicles? They still will bring attendant traffic jams, lots of demand for more highways we might not otherwise need, loss of valuable city space to store cars, i.e. parking lots, worsening of housing affordability to store cars, i.e. garages, to say nothing of mineral blindness that we've just been talking about. We really need to think further ahead than just trying to take all our fossil fuel vehicles off the road and replace them with electric vehicles. Right, going on, glimpses into the COP30 vibe. Nelson City's got a great climate team, and one of its great members is Daniela Ramirez, who's from Chile, and she has taken the opportunity to go on a self-funded trip to COP30. We've had an interview with Daniela recently. I've interviewed her again in the run-up to COP30, and apologies to listeners if this comes out a bit after the COP has finished. So my apologies there, but we'll have other interviews with Daniela, which I hope will update us. Here are some things that she's given me as a lead into the COP, like a strong focus on action rather than negotiation. Let's get stuff happening. I like that. And a serious elevation of local government into the COP arena. That is something to keep our eye on and to take seriously, because local government is in a way where the rubber hits the road on climate action, and they should have a presence in the COP arena. And then there's the intriguing climate mutirao. And if you wonder what that is, then have a wee listen. We'll give you a link to the radio show where it is, or you can Google climate mutirao and can hear all of that and more, including a lovely story that Daniela recounts about meeting Cristiana Figueres of Paris Agreement fame and Jacinda Ardern. And it's all on the webpage for my Climate Matters radio show, which is in the show notes anyway. Okay, the next item. Are the emissions of plug-in hybrids really plug-in hype? Hybrid electric vehicles, just to explain what they are, combine a low-range electric battery and motor. And by low-range, that's typically, say, around 60 or 70 kilometers, with a conventional fossil fuel engine, and they switch between the two through a range of different modes. Plug-in hybrids, known as PHEVs, can charge directly from the mains or from the fossil fuel motor, whereas straight hybrids only charge from the fossil fuel motor. So straight hybrids are really only just fossil fuel cars that sometimes run on the electricity generated by the fossil fuels. So anyway, having done that introduction, the reference here is to a Guardian report making the point that a massive study, and we'll give you links to that as well, casts a very long shadow over the emissions benefits of PHEVs. And it's worth noting that a selling point of PHEVs, especially in earlier days before the electric vehicles developed such good range, was the ability to commute all week in electric mode and then go on long weekend trips on petrol. And that worked well, for example, for one of my family members. However, The Guardian reports an analysis of 800,000 European cars and found that the real-world pollution from plug-in hybrids was nearly five times greater than lab tests, and that put them almost at the point of not being any better than a straight fossil fuel vehicle. The study, which fittingly was called Smokescreen, the Growing PHEV Emissions Scandal, and we'll give a link to that, of course, delved into driver behavior, vehicle operating modes, and lots more, and found that vehicles claiming on average to reduce emissions 75% generally only achieved a 19% reduction. If you have a PHEV or are thinking about buying one, do take this seriously and include figuring out if your car has the sort of settings that will let it operate reliably on the lowest emissions mode, rather than, for example, immediately cutting in the fossil fuel engine when you put your foot down to overtake something. So anyway, that's all of this Climate Matters, except we haven't given you an answer to the quiz. And the question was, what was Kaya decomposition? And what Kaya decomposition is, and it's not a composting term, and it's not a way greenhouse gases decay, but it is a means of disaggregating climate emissions into their component sources. Disaggregating means splitting up. And that is very useful for analyzing, for example, policy approaches to reducing emissions. So it's actually based on a very simple mathematical concept. I won't try and explain it here, but it results in quite interesting charts. And there's one there which illustrates the decomposition, for example, of global emissions growth, showing that taking 2000 as a baseline year, in other words, marking rises or falls around that, the biggest driver of global emissions growth is global GDP by a big margin. Next comes the increase in energy use, and that's actually coupled with GDP. And next comes the use of the emissions from fossil CO2, which also, of course, is coupled to energy and GDP. But there is declines in energy use due to energy being lower emissions. I think that's due to a progressive switch to renewables, although let's be serious, fossil fuel energy is still rising faster than renewables are replacing it. And also GDP is getting a bit more energy efficient, which means that we produce fewer emissions or need less energy for each unit of GDP. But GDP is growing so much that it eclipses all of that. So anyway, that's what Kaya decomposition is. So I do hope that you've enjoyed today's Climate Matters. You can, of course, subscribe to it. We'll put the link to the Climate Matters Substack page if you want to do that, or you can share it with other people through the same link if you want to do that as well. So anyway, thanks for your company and for joining me. And I, of course, I hope I enjoy your company again next week. And of course, kia kaha for the climate. As you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson-Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz and podcasts of Climate Matters and other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz. So on that note, thanks again for your company and kia kaha for the climate.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.